Testing 1, 2. Interview with Walter Williams, April 22nd, 1980, Long Beach, by Greg Perkins, Cal State University Long Beach Oral History Resource Center.
Was not a plaintiff. I think the plaintiff in this case was, one was the name of Blakeney, B-L-A-K-E. N-Y, anyone. Andrew Blakeney, F-L, I believe. Versus the flagship guard worker versus the Boilermaker General. Now, the shipyard workers' command was not the plaintiff, but we led the struggle. And we did the organizational work. And like I say, as a result of the decisions that came out of the courts that required the Boilermakers to take blacks in on an equal basis, or to cease and desist from attempting to organize in any fashion. We find many black people now who have steady jobs in the shipyard industry that would not have been available to them. Sure, had not been for the struggle and that court decision.
Could you say a little more about how the black auxiliary function that was different from the parent union?
Well, it was a subordinate organization run entirely by black officers. We couldn't do anything. We could hold meetings, but anything we decided to do had to first be ratified by the parent local 92. In other words, 835 was an auxiliary, and that's the way auxiliary functions. That's the way they function. So we didn't want any part of that. We knew it was a temporary thing. And we knew that unless we became regular members and with job rights equivalent to, the white regular members, that we weren't going to be in those industries after the war. And this is what we were looking forward to. It wasn't a social thing that Ed Blackwell claimed. He was the executive secretary of Local 92, and I offered to, try to work out a plan where we could become regular members, and because he called and he was complaining and raising hell, and telling me that he thought that I was a bright fella, he said, I'm disappointed. I mean, what right did he have to be disappointed in me? He already knew me. How did he know how bright I was, how stupid I was? And so I insisted on, trying to work it out. I said, let me bring a committee in there. Just a small committee or a group in there and try to talk it out. So he was very reluctant to do so, but he agreed and we went in. And, this is where he tells me that after I told him that look, the only thing we're interested in, Billy, is job security. I said, we want to work, if it's possible, to work in shipyards after the war. Said, we want to work in the shipyards as many of us as we can. And I said, that's the only reason. I said, we want equal membership in this union. He said, that's got nothing to do with it. He said, all you want is to come in. And, I'm just telling you like it. This could be for the record. I don't give a damn, but I mean, it's amusing, that this guy would take this attitude. He says, all you want to do is come in here and be a regular member because, we have dances and picnics and all that. He says, all you guys want to do is be members so you can be with our white women. Now, this is a fact. Here's a labor leader. He had so little class that he, I guess racism is racism. Actually, I said, well, there's just no way. You know, this guy's,
this wasn't a membership meeting. This was just the
executive board? No, this was just, wasn't even a board meeting. It's just a meeting between Blackwell and the committee of fellows that accompanied me to see Blackwell on the question of trying to work out ways and means of integrating Local 92.
Did you make any direct appeals to the white local to try to organize them?
No. I couldn't see at that time any feasible strategies, you know, to use in that direction. And, you know, that could really work. Because
Herbert Ward and CIM?
Yeah, well, Herbert Ward was... oh, you're talking about different AFL unions?
No.
Because he was a member of the IAM.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I met him. I went to school with Herb Ward. Right. We went to Jefferson High School.
Third time.
Oh, good. You see, oh, that's a wonderful guy. Great. But he knew about the struggle.
Yeah.
And every now and then I'd run into him at the YMCA or the community and always give me that shot. Hey,
yeah.
We'll get it, man. You know, hang in, walk in.
Right.
Yeah.
You were in a different situation than he was.
I would love to talk to Herb Ward about his experience with an IAM. Seemingly that I've always felt that IAM had a little more class as a union. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
But he has become an officer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what capacity, but last time I thought of it.
We did.
We were 4,000 black people as compared to, well, but I feel they had at least 50,000 ship levels.
There were
5,000
black?
Yeah. Scattered, you know, in Florida, in various ship parks. I don't know, I kind of felt that was the long route, the long way around. You know, the educational process is good, you know, and all that. We won a lot of things, and I'm sure that in the Boilermakers Union there were those white members who felt that, you know, it would be a good thing if the union would shrivel up and die. Collapse if they accepted black members. But we didn't choose to go that route. We didn't choose to enlist support of other AFL trade unions. We went right to the core of the thing that was, you know, just taking on the Boilermakers local, the whole international, and using the courts as much as possible. And after we found out the FEPC had limited powers and but I will always appreciate the fact, because it was the beginning of something big. after 8802 came, I think, a couple of stronger, a couple of amendments to the original FEPC, which eventually gave it teeth and made it a stronger thing. After that, you know, there came what the affirmative action.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way that black people have been going. And after I left the Boilermakers Union, I worked briefly in Los Angeles, Soles Field, but only for a brief period. There's a welder in there. I found out that they needed workers down on the waterfront. I understood the salary to be very good there. And so I left Soul Steel to go to work at in the longshore industry. And I found a home. I mean, I enjoyed the work. Outdoors, just ideal. Just what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But things weren't rosy there either, because Well, they were prepared for, I guess, the influx of black workers, and I soon found out that they really didn't intend for black workers to stay on the waterfront during the post-war era. But one of the first things they had us do was to sign a commitment that we would only work in a temporary capacity as longshoremen, temporary longshoremen. And I had been forewarned, you know, that I was going to run into a problem that we blacks were going to run into a problem. And I was told that it was highly discriminatory, and I couldn't, you know, it wasn't making much sense to me, you know, at the time. While I was down there, it wasn't making sense to me, because I said, well, what's the stevedore? What the hell? I mean, blacks have always been identified as stevedore. You know, you read the history on the levees in the South, everywhere, in the Gulf War. And so, but it was a fact. And I found that Local 13, prior to World War II, was practically where they white. If there were any blacks down there, they were passing, you know. And so the problem was to figure out how to become permanently employed as a longshoreman down there. And because the job was, like I say, I liked the work, the money was good money, and I really wanted to stay there. And other black people of the same opinion, you know, feeling the same way. So we got together, and when we realized that we were there for longer than 6 months, we began to demand in return for the money they were collecting. And they said it wasn't dues, they said it was for something else, but we said, as far as we're concerned, it's dues, you know. So we're paying to work here. We want a regular membership status. So then they gave us probationary cards, and but the war was winding up, and I was feeling very shaky as to whether, you know, we'd be able to stay there, you know, before the war terminated. Felt very insecure about that, but I said, well, we push as hard as we can. Maybe we'll make it. Maybe a few of us can become regular members, and we'll be ready to down again. Maybe not, but we have to do it.
So what year did you start it? 13?
13 and I think it was the latter part of latter part of 43. And, well, it wasn't hard to organize a group that would work for permanent legislation out there and for regular membership renewal. Because, as I said, there were quite a few black fellows who were aggressive and really wanted that kind of work, see real job security in the longshore jobs down there. And so we began to push for a regular membership in the union. And as I said, they gave us a probationary status. They issued probationary cards. And, so after 6 months of that, we said, look, we want regular membership. So then they gave us books as warehousemen, you know. To us, that wasn't the McCoy. McCoy was for Class A registration as longshoremen, because the warehouseman, as it was at that time, we weren't privileged to go out to be dispatched to the jobs on an equal basis. We soon found out it was really a second-class status in the union. We paid book. We paid dues as book warehouse members, but we were second class members because of the experience of having to wait until all of the Class A longshoremen were dispatched first, and then if there was any work left, then they would dispatch the book warehouse. You know? So then we started raising hell about that, and they said we want a regular Class A membership, either that or we want a court. You know, And so then they said, well, okay, we don't believe in second-class citizenship. We will give you books as Class A longshoremen. We will give you equal status. But before that happened, let's see, it was VE Day, VJ Day, then VE Day, right?
Mm-hmm.
VE Day came past, and so they said, wow, we got the treasure we need. We cut them loose because they claimed that there's not enough work to go around. But that's casual work down there. You see, it's like voluntary work. You go down there, you check in whenever you feel like checking in. And if you want to work 4 or 5 days, you work. If you want to work one day and say, the hell with it, I'm not going back for a week or two, that's the way you do. We had a plug system down there. And you just put that plug in the board. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they pull that plug out. And the performance was when you're actually plugging in, because they had dispatchers back there who would check when you plugged were in. And you would go out, and of course, when you plugged in. And so, like I say, it was casual work. It still is, by nature. It's still work. When you want to work, work as long as you want to work. If there's work there, 30 days in a row, you want to take a couple of weeks off, although we don't have the plug, we have a check-in system. We have a number, a registration number check-in system. And so, realizing it was casual work, we took the attitude, well, you know, who cares, you know, whether we're still here, you know, after the war. Now, it doesn't make any difference. You know, if there's no work, we starve. You know, if there is work, then we all eat, you know. If there's little work, then we, you know, we divide it up. Because we, that's the way it had always been, and we felt to change it was to be a discriminatory. It was, you know, was really discriminatory. It's only because you had a lot of blacks there, that was thing that you really wanted to change things. Because prior to that, there was no difference. You shared the starvation and you shared the good times. And nevertheless, the union voted us out on the basis of there not being enough work to go around, and the Pacific Maritime Association, which was the Waterfront Employers Association at the time,
mm-hmm.
they concurred with the union's action, and they were both together on it, to say the least, anyway, and they deregistered us. And so we proceeded to hire a lawyer. I left there and became a hog carrier
mm-hmm.
Briefly, almost 3 years. And but we carried on the court struggle, and eventually they called us back. There was an agreement that they would take us back, even when they voted us out. You know, we contested this thing. We protested it at the meeting, at the membership meeting. And I can recall one guy, Bill Lawrence, who's a perennial president, officer of some kind of union from year to year, in and out. He was one of the very few, in fact, he was the only Caucasian trade union leader who rose to the occasion and protested the action of the union voting us out. Deregistering us and voting to have us deregistered. And he told them that there'd be a time when they'd probably regret, you know, having taken the action, that we could probably sue and cost him in a lot of trouble. And he really made his opposition to it very plain. And I remember the lawyer, Ben Margolis, telling them, advising them also that this was morally wrong, and as far as he was concerned, it was unlawful.
But he was representing them at the time.
Well, he was representing them,
yeah.
But he advised them not to do it.
Yeah.
He said, want my opinion? He says, I'm giving you a legal opinion, and that it would be an error to do this. program didn't do any good. They voted us out anyway. And as I said, we had to go to court. We had to hire a lawyer. And they agreed. Getting back to the meeting, there was a commitment on the part of the union at the time that they deregistered us that we would be the very first group to be re-registered in the future if work picked up. Yeah. Which, we didn't put any faith in that. We knew that we had to push and we had to continue the struggle. Like I say, after 3 years, they finally did call us back and re-registered us. And they called us the 500, the group of 500, because I think that was the total number that was registered at the time, but most of the 500 were black. Mm-hmm. There were a few Chicanos and then a few Caucasians.
Ben said about 420 out of the 500 was his estimate. Was that sound right to you?
Yeah. The blacks. So they call us the 500. However, with this group, there were a number of white fellows. I know that they jeopardized their chances of going back and becoming re-registered ahead of us by standing with us. But I remember one guy. It was very encouraging. It was a very hard one. His name was Norwood Felt. When asked by L.B. Thomas what he was doing standing in with us when we had gone before the, this is when we'd gone before the executive board to ask them to reconsider their action and to reconsider, I forget the term, but anyway, to rescind the action that they had taken. Thomas, who I always considered to be a very, very bitter racist person, he's been the secretary and president of Local 13 in and outside of the column, almost as long as Del Arnt and as often as Del Arnt. He asked Norwood Felt, he said, "What are you doing here? So what is your, what have you got to say?" So Norwood said, "Well," he says, "this group asked for reinstatement and re-registration," he said, "and I know what's going on," he says, "this is where I belong, right here, with this group. You deregistered them, you deregistered me, so they're asking you to reconsider," and he said, "I want to be reconsidered when they're reconsidered." And then he went on to lecture him about being, he said, "I'm from Florida." He said, "I left that place," he said, "just because of such crap as this." He said, "I didn't expect this sort of thing to happen here." He said, "But if you want to know, why I'm here," he said, you understand pretty much why I'm here. He said, I don't like it. He said, "When you take them back, you take me back. You take it all back." So I'll never forget the guy.
Do you think he was exceptional, though? You don't think the majority of the
majority of the membership was that way, because I see the background of that membership is that most of these, most of the old timers in ILWU, and that's what they were at that time. And if there are any of them around now, they are very, very much old timers. But most of that membership were people who lived in Pedro, Wilmington, the local area there. And in Pedro and Wilmington, there weren't very many black people at all. And the Chicanos and whites and community and the Slab community comprised make up more or less of the longshore membership. And men from those ethnic communities. And being that blacks, black people weren't, in evidence in Pedro in large numbers. And in fact, I could remember going to Pedro, and I'd have to look a long time before I'd see a black person. But I'd always see a lot of Chicano people and a lot of white people. And when I say white people, I'm talking about the Slavs and Paddock and what have you. And
Harry Bridges made a lot of noise during the war about being very conscious of having blacks in the Union, being in favor of civil rights. What kind of influence does that have on these people? That it does, you know, roll off their back? Or
yeah, because that's the way he would, that's the kind of noise he would make. It would, you know, it would be a little noise, and that's all. He never, Harry would come down. Now, this is after we got back into the Union. We asked for his help. Let me say this before I get into anything else. We asked for Harry's help. And, we couldn't even hear from the guy. You know, we're writing letters, and you know, we didn't hear from him. You know, telling him what was going on down here. When he'd come down, and I remember him coming down one time, and he just didn't appear to be interested. He'd say, look, it's a local problem. Well, I was not as experienced as I would have liked to have been at that time, and I wasn't as much a student of the Constitution as I came to be later on, you know, the local Union Constitution, because I think I could have, we could have put a lot more pressure on Harry than we did. But even after we learned how to use the Constitution, he was very elusive, very much a politician. When we got back, we started the fight for upgrading, okay, becoming qualifying ourselves for the more skilled jobs like operating the lift trucks, the lift kidneys, and driving winches. And the big fight came, and winches, and then that's the real skill category, and crane operations.
For you now.
And gangs, huh?
Yeah, under crane operation
now, and hitting ship gangs. Getting the ship gangs is a big issue. Well, everything was on first serve basis, you know, prior to our making this push for skilled jobs and for some of the better, you know, classifications of work there. Hitting ship gangs was a big thing, and becoming foreman was another. And we found all kinds of resistance. The local itself, you know, would, they weren't too favorable. We'd get almost there. We'd almost get there with a vote. But, usually, I mean, 99.9% of the cases, we'd lose the shouting match. Okay, so we went to Harry. I took a delegation up there. I think this was in 59, because we weren't making any headway in getting blacks promoted on the job as foremen. When they would be short of foremen, they would, I don't care how much seniority the black dude would have, they'd always, the ship boss who had the right to select hatch foremen who would work the various hatches, he'd always wind up selecting someone other than a black guy. So when we took this delegation up there, we weren't making any headway in the local. We said, well, let's go to Harry. He's head of the Coast Committee, and you know, he knows we have no discrimination clause in the contract. So, so happened when we got there, this delegation, to complain about the way that promotions were being handled, the way blacks were being discriminated against in Local 15. We found that L.B. Thomas was there and Bill Lawrence was there. They were the local officers on Local 13. It happened to be up in San Francisco at the time. And they asked to sit in on the meeting with Harry, with our delegation. Harry asked if it was okay, and I didn't have any objections. They knew what was going on. I preferred it that way, you know. What was there to hide? So we made our complaints. We told Harry that we knew that there was no discrimination clause in the contract, that there was no reason why blacks had to be picked over, and we left out when they came to promote, being promoted to boss status, temporary one-night status, you know, bossing status when we were short. And there's no reason why the union should change its policy when it did. When we had a guy by the name of Hezekiah Watson in line for a ship gang, he was at number two in line after having waited on this rotating list, you know, which was not on a seniority basis, the first come first served basis. So they waited until gangs were handed out, and he became, moved up to number two spot. Then the union.